All right, it's a couple minutes after 9 at 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, where for this next hour programming, opinions and views expressed are not necessarily those of KUCI, UC Irvine, or the University of California Board of Regents. It's time now for Talking Animals on KUCI.
The buzzard said one day, as he flew across the way, he spotted me, then he licked his chops, and this is what he said. Ah, die, 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 said the buzzard. Die, die, what a meal you'll be. Die, 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 said the buzzard, and bring that millimeat to me. Die, 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 said the buzzard. Die, die, die right now. I said, the buzzard, you ain't gonna live always no how. Boy, you just keep on walking. Why don't you stand still? My, you look so delicious. Hold still, Jack, while I get my bill. Die, 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 said the buzzard. Die, die, ain't you got no sense? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da, said the buzzard. Come on, die, save fuel expense. Mr. Buzzard, hi, hi, don't you blow your top. My, 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 Mr. Buzzard, I just double dare you to stop. Hi, 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 Mr. Buzzard, hi, hi, why you big fat bird? My, hi, hi, Mr. Buzzard, there's a meat shortage, or ain't you heard? Boy, with this meat shortage all over the town, you just fly down a little lower, let your big feet hit the ground. Hi, 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 Mr. Buzzard. Hi, hi, come here to me. Hi, 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 Mr. Buzzard, and be my Sunday specialty.
All right, that's Rudy Green and his orchestra with a jaunty animal tune called Buzzard Pie. As we ease into today's Talking Animals on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine, streaming live on the internet at KUCI.org, and the whole enterprise is broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine, unless we forget, especially on an animal-related show, that's home of the Anteaters. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'll be with you at 10 o'clock this morning with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. Right off the bat, I'd like to tell you that for the next hour, you can reach us directly by phone at 949-824-5824, 949-UCI, KUCI. And I absolutely urge you to use that number. Call us at any point in the show. Don't be shy. I'm telling you, we love, love, love to get calls. You can also instant message us via AOL Instant Messenger. The screen name is Talking Animals. Other slightly less immediate ways to be in touch with us include emailing us, talkinganimals@AOL.com, and checking out our website, talkinganimals.net. Again, make no mistake, that's .net, folks. Also, before we move on, I want to thank Serena Sharp for another rip-snorting, provocative, hot-topic-laden call confused by a person getting rendition of the Serena Sharp Show. Meanwhile, here we're talking animals. Primarily, we strive to learn about animals and animal issues from our guests, from news items, from your calls, from assorted other sources. But we're also here each week to celebrate animals through music, comedy, and other means. We aim for a spirited balance of those elements. Got so spirited, I can barely say spirited. As you can readily glean by visiting our nifty website, talkinganimals.net, where nearly every show we've ever broadcast is archived. Clearly, the heart of the program is the interview we conduct each week with some notable inhabitant of some province of the animal world. Today, our guest is Dr. Temple Grandin, an internationally renowned animal expert, longtime consultant in designing the most humane methods for transporting and handling livestock and meat processing plants, a PhD associate professor of animal science at Colorado State University, and Dr. Grandin is also autistic and an author, most recently of Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior, which has received rave reviews in just about every publication you can imagine, and some you can't, and is now on the New York Times bestseller list. So we'll talk about the new book, her autism, some of the work and consulting she's done and is doing, and more when Dr. Temple Grandin joins us in a few minutes here on Talking Animals. Meanwhile, it's time for our weekly look at items of interest in animal news, and I want to remind you of the phone number to join us on the show with your own comments and questions about animals. Not only this week's animal news items, but also any other animal topic you'd care to discuss, announcements, observations, of course, any stories you might have spotted. They'd all be most welcome. Phone number is 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. So turning now to interesting and or important developments. Recently, in animal news, typically these are local, regional, national, occasionally international animal stories of note that seem important to spotlight, and with any luck, to get your comments on, discuss. We also try to include a few announcements of upcoming events or activities that you may want to pencil in on your calendar. So once again, with that preamble immediately behind us, let's talk turkey, as it were. Produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. Start right off with something international and significant to boot. Headline, Vietnam bans farming of ducks amid bird flu. Vietnamese officials have ordered a nationwide ban on duck and goose farming in a bid to head off a mounting bird flu outbreak that has claimed 13 lives since late December. The waterfowl are a reservoir for the virus and can carry it without becoming ill, making it difficult to identify infected animals. Officials in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam's largest city, this week ordered all ducks to be killed. Quote, these steps show an appreciation of the realities of the disease, said Klaus Storr, head of the World Health Organization's Global Influenza Program. But they are the... But they are the first steps of a marathon. Vietnam requested help Thursday from the WHO and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization to combat the bird flu outbreak that has spread over half of the nation's provinces. There are also cases in neighboring Thailand and Cambodia. About 100 million birds were culled in 10 countries when the avian influenza virus, known as H5N1, raged through the region last winter. Since then, the disease has killed 45 people. After a lull, the number of infections has surged since December. Vietnamese and UN officials agreed that a team of international experts would be assembled within 2 weeks. The UN agencies will provide field and lab equipment to improve surveillance and reporting. UN officials also will conduct epidemiology. Wow. All right. Yikes. Okay. Studies and train lab personnel across Vietnam in rapid detection of the virus. Sluggish testing and reporting previously fostered the spread of this disease. And it goes on from there. Here's one that, well, actually, initially probably doesn't bear any comment, although if you've got a comment, 949-824-5824 when you hear this one. The Reverend Al Sharpton has joined PETA in calling for a boycott of fast food chain KFC in a new TV and radio campaign. Sharpton is urging the black community to join the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals boycott of the franchise, the Animal Protection Group announced Thursday. Quote, if KFC wants to take our money and use it to pay for sloppy practices and hurt animals, I say we send them a message that this is not going to happen, Sharpton says in the end. Trepton and Pete are seeking improvements to KFC's practices regarding the defeathering and debeaking of chickens, as well as a halt to using growth-promoting drugs. Last June, Pete recorded footage of alleged mistreatment of birds at a KFC supplier in West Virginia. And of course, this will tie in, perhaps not surprisingly, to our conversation in a few moments with Dr. Temple Grandin. I suppose you could make the same claim, perhaps more indirectly, but still, to this next story. This is Dateline, Sioux Falls City, South Dakota. Or as one of the Bush daughters called it, Psyox. You heard that story, right? All right. Don't have time to go into it now, but beautiful. Young Canadian cattle will begin streaming back into the United States next month, and for many ranchers and dairy farmers, it's either dangerous or about time. On one side of the fence are U.S. ag operators and politicians who fear as many as 2 million Canadian cattle will increase the possibility of mad cow disease, knock the bottom out of livestock prices here, and ruin the beef export market. The U.S. market already took one staggering hit after an imported cow from Canada was confirmed to have mad cow disease in December 2003. Across the border, ag operators say the United States is using the fact that mad cow was discovered in Canadian beef to create an artificial trade barrier that has devastated Canada's beef producers and damaged its dairy industry. Goes on from there as well. Let's see. Gonna have probably a little shorter news segment because we want to have plenty of time for our interview with Dr. Grandin. But so let's step right into our mid, and maybe this is mid, maybe it's even past mid, news quiz question. For a while, long time, we were just doing true-false. We had a 50-50 chance. Now we've changed it a little bit, but still the odds are pretty good. It's a multiple choice, but we only give you three choices, so my God. Still 33 and a third chance, just guessing wildly, right? All right, so we're taking this, and again, this was sent to us by one of our very loyal listeners, which you can do, again, by emailing us at talkinganimals@aol.com. So this is taken from the response to a thing that Pedigree Pet Food, where they recently surveyed more than 1,500 dog owners across the country. And this is taken from those results. So here's the question. How many of those dog owners admit they talk to their dog as if he, she were a human? How many of those dog owners admit they talk to their dog as if he, she were a human? Is it 33%, 52%, or 71%? 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. And while you're mulling that, let me just quickly hit some of the possible prizes you could choose from if you were to correctly guess that, or later when we play Name That Animal Tune. We still have, I think, at least one copy of the new DVD by Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. We've got some pretty cool Talking Animals merch, actually, at this point, including Talking Animals t-shirts, Talking Animals sweatshirts, Talking Animals mug. So that's among your choices. We've got t-shirts from other animal organizations. We've got lint rollers. We've got cat toys, dog collars. We've got little cool necklaces with handcrafted animal charms. We've got a bunch of other stuff, too. So, again, that's if you call in with the correct answer, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. Again, the question, how many dog owners that participated in the survey by Pedigree Pet Food admit they talk to their dog as if he, she were a human? 33%, 52%, or 71%? Also, before we wind down, I want to mention this over the next couple of weeks. This ties into our guest last week on Talking Animals, Cyrus Mejia, one of the founders of the Best Friends Animal Society, which runs the biggest animal sanctuary for abandoned and abused dogs and cats and other animals in the nation. But he's also a really accomplished artist, so we spent most of our time last week talking about the Best Friends Art Project, which is sort of a traveling exhibit, and it's going to be opening in Los Angeles February 25th and on view there through March 18th. It'll be specifically at 2 California Plaza, which is at 350 South Grand Avenue in Los Angeles. And It'll include works from the 575 Project, which Cyrus explained that basically around 5 million unwanted pets are put to death in shelters each year. And so the 575 actually represents the number of dogs and cats killed each hour. So, but there's a bunch of other of his paintings and some great photography by photographer Clay Myers and other things as well. So you can call us or email us to find out more about that. You can also visit Cyrus's website at cyrusmejia.com, CyrusMejia.com. And again, it's going to be a really cool exhibit. In fact, if you visit that website, click on paintings just to get a little sneak preview of some of Cyrus's work. It's really terrific, I think. So, that's coming up shortly. And perhaps our last story for today, at least for now. Laurel Canyon, that's right here in Southern California, but you wouldn't necessarily think it as the story unfolds. Laurel Canyon residents could breathe a little easier on February 3rd when a wild African bobcat, a serval, was captured in Laurel Canyon. Local residents had been advised on January 25th to be on the lookout for the serval, which was spotted wandering on the 2000 block of Davies Way in Laurel Canyon. Servals are indigenous to Africa and are considered exotic in California, according to the Los Angeles Department of Animal Services. Many local residents had spotted the unusual wildcat and were able to photograph the animal, which appeared to be wearing a black collar and a gold tag. Department spokesman Jackie David confirmed that the animal is still believed to be someone's pet. While the animal permit is necessary to own a serval in the state of California, Fish and Game confirmed that no wild animal permits have been issued for a serval in the Los Angeles area. The serval was captured on 4:45 p.m. in good condition without incident. According to David, wildlife officers had set traps for the animal throughout the Laurel Canyon area. The serval is currently being held at the Department of Animal Services. So I think that's, for now at least, going to do it for this edition of the Animal News. If you have ever any news stories or announcements or events you'd like to bring to our attention, please feel free to email us those at talkinganimals@AOL.com. We'd also love to encourage you to email us with any comments about the show, suggestions of future guests, ideas about animal songs, animal comedy bits, any other animal topic that's on your mind. Again, email is talkinganimals@AOL.com. And I want to remind you one more time, while we can, well, we always can, but here's a good chance, really, good opportunity, good time, about the Talking Animals website. It's talkinganimals.net, and please check it out when you can. Sign up for the email list, so we can keep you posted on upcoming guests and other announcements. And you'll find archives, again, just about of every show we've ever done, synopses that accompany each of those archives, and photographs, articles that we've written, articles that have been written about us, links, audio pieces, and more. So stop by, take a look around. Again, it's talkinganimals.net. Time now to step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which, as always, of course, involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Eddie Izzard with a snippet of a piece called Mad European Cow in today's Comedy Corner here, KUCI.
But you never see a seal that's bad, do you? Never see a seal that... Yeah, yeah. Oh, all right. Sorry, it's just not my thing. I thought, give me Camp 3, and then I... They're just phenomenal. I think that was God or Mother Nature or the God Cow saying, okay, seals, give them blubber to keep them warm, fins to move them along, slippery, slidey shape. Good with balls, I think I'll put it here. And it could be other animals have secret things they're good at, like tigers. Might be good with banjos. But no one's thrown a banjo to a tiger. Bang, 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 bang. Bang, 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 bang. Ding 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 ding. Whoa, I'm a tiger. So that feels, and then swans can kill you with their arms, apparently. But I don't know how they do it, because it doesn't quite work. But I think it's their beaks. I think they sharpen their beaks and they'll take your head off. And cows, our British cows, they could kick,
because
they have mad cow disease, you know?
Right, see how it all ties in to our news story and all? That's right. That was Eddie Izzard with a snippet of a piece called Mad European Cow here on today's edition of the Comedy Corner. That was taken from his album Circle. Comedy Corner, of course, one of the signature features of Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and you're listening to Talking Animals on KUCI 88.9 FM. Broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. As many of you know, we also stream live on the internet at KUCI.org. Some of you, no doubt, are listening that very way. Some of you perhaps arrived there through our swell website, talkinganimals.net. Before we proceed, I'm obliged to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in Talking Animals are not necessarily those of KUCI, UC Irvine, or the University of California Board of Regents. Earlier in the show, I mentioned that this week's guest is Dr. Temple Grandin, an internationally renowned animal expert, longtime consultant in designing the most humane methods for transporting and handling livestock and meat processing plants, a PhD associate professor of animal science, Colorado State University. Dr. Grandin is also autistic and an author, most recently, of Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior, which has gotten fabulous reviews everywhere. And recently cracked the New York Times bestseller list, and I noticed moved up a bit yesterday. So, the fact is, the book's become so successful that her publisher has wildly revamped her schedule, meaning she suddenly became unavailable to join us live this morning. It's a long plan. We worked this out several weeks ago. But Dr. Grandin called me personally to let me know and to schedule a time to record the interview so it could still air this morning. So, not only enormously accomplished and fascinating, but a class act, too. So, recorded Wednesday. This is Dr. Temple Grandin here on Talking Animal. Okay, let's welcome to Talking Animals Dr. Temple Grandin. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Grandin.
It's wonderful to be here.
Well, we appreciate taking the time, and gosh, congrats on the book's enormous success on the New York Times bestseller list, rave reviews everywhere, just including out here on Sunday in the LA Times book review, and just everywhere I pick up a publication, there's a story and or a rave review, so congrats.
Well, thank you very much.
There's so much to really cover about the book, in fact, and just there's so many ideas bursting from it, we could really probably schedule a week's worth of these interviews, but and probably still not cover all the fascinating stuff here, but let's just jump in and cover what we can. And in fact, really, the book's very success might be sort of an interesting jumping off point. I mean, no doubt accounting for much of the book's popularity and appeal is sort of the very straightforward conversational way the book is written. Even a layperson like myself can really understand and get excited about these ideas. Yet, a key premise of the book is that the one quality, among others, shared by animals and autistic people like yourself is that you don't think in words or in language.
No, I don't. I think in pictures. And, of course, animals are not going to be thinking in language. They're going to be thinking in associations of smells, sounds, touches, pictures, and tactile sensations. And being a person who doesn't think in language has, helped me, understand how animals could think.
But at the same time, I mean, here we are speaking, and we're talking about this amazing book, and you've certainly written others before. And actually, I guess I should hasten to point out that this is really a collaboration of sorts, really, with your co-author, Catherine Johnson. So how much is finding ways to kind of operate well with words and language, and especially in a collaboration with a fellow author?
Well,
like
with
that?
Me, what language does is it narrates the pictures that are in my mind. It sort of narrates the videos. And the richness of my thinking is in the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You read my earlier book, Thinking in Pictures. It's much more technical.
Sure.
Now, when I worked with Catherine, she wanted to hear me talk.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want me to send her an article in Science that I thought had a great concept. She wanted me to talk to her about that article.
Sure.
And I'm just really pleased how Catherine captured my voice. And we had hours and hours and hours and hours of phone conversations where I talked about all of the different concepts that were in the book.
Well, that carries through because, when you read the book, again, whether you're, very, sort of an academic or science-oriented or, again, a layperson like myself, I mean, you really feel like you're in our living room or I'm in yours, practically. I mean, it seems like it's a conversation and it's very accessible, a lot of great examples, I've never really spoken to you before, but I really feel like your voice is very well captured in the book. So.
Well, this is what Catherine, this is what she did. Because I do a lot of lectures on animal handling, and uh-huh. They're much more conversational than my technical writing. And while I'd talk to her, she'd be typing away on the keyboard, and then when she'd work on, putting all the pieces together, it was just, really, really great.
Sure. Well, before we go too much further, really, then perhaps it'd be useful for those who haven't read either, the new book or even the previous ones, or just otherwise may not be that familiar with autism.
to ask simply, you know, what is autism? What are some of the key traits of an autistic person?
Well, autism varies all the way from a genius like Einstein down to a person that's going to remain nonverbal and will have to live in a supervised living situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a developmental disorder that the child is born with. It's due to abnormal growth in the brain. It's not caused by the environment. It's caused by in the emotional parts of the brain, the neurons don't grow right. In the frontal cortex of the brain, research has shown that the what would be the computer cables that connect the different parts of the frontal cortex together just grow in tangles. So what ends up happening is you end up using the primary sensory memory as what you think with. You know, what most people would call the subconscious, that's what I think with.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how can you form a concept when you think in pictures? Well, the way you do it is you sort the pictures into categories. Okay, like in the mind of an animal, a real common one is men are bad and ladies are good. I hate to say it, guys, but unfortunately, guys handle an animal roughly more often than ladies do, and they'll often ladies is good and guys are bad. That's that's an association based on pictures or on the sounds of voices.
Hmm. And so. One of the things you sort of pointed out is that there's really quite a range of, I guess, the way that autism affects different people. But one of the many things I found interesting in the book was sort of what I guess turns out to be sort of a myth or just not precise enough, is that this thing that autistic kids don't want to be touched, when in fact, for the reasons you sort of touched on a moment ago, the way their nervous systems are different from another kid, they just can't handle.
Well, the thing is, sensory stimulation just becomes overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was a little kid and the school bell went off, it hurt my ears.
Yeah.
It's like all of my sensory systems were turned on super loud. So when people touched me, it was just like a barrage of tidal wave of stimulation. I just couldn't tolerate it.
Yeah. And really, maybe this is a good time as any to then, in a way, talk about frontal lobes. I mean, it really seems like that's kind of a key element that sort of courses through the new book, is that really the biggest difference between the animal brain and the human brain is the frontal lobes, and obviously animals be smaller, less developed, but that also extends into another parallel with autistic people, if I follow this correctly.
Well, frontal lobes, basically what the frontal lobes do is they associate every other part of the brain together. And this is what makes abstract thinking possible. But I don't have abstract thinking. You know, if I have to think about existentialism philosophy, I don't have any way to think about that. Now, if you ask me to think about, how I'm going to go shopping, I see a picture of that. Or you could ask me about something more scientific, and I can use what I call a visual symbol picture. And one example of this is when I discuss brain scan research with people with autism.
Mm-hmm.
People with autism are really good at a thing called the hidden figure test, where you sort of might look for a picture of a Dalmatian hidden in a whole other thing.
Yeah, I found that really interesting. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
And the autistic person will instantly see that. And when you put them in the brain scan machine, the visual part of the brain is illuminated and everything else is shut off. You put the normal person in the brain scan machine and you've got a whole lot of things lit up in the brain, and some of the language stuff gets lit up, and that interferes with doing this purely visual task.
In a sense, it overrides.
That's right.
Okay.
It overrides. And
mm-hmm.
then the way I can pictorially think about this, I say the brain scan of the autistic person is like a bright little cabin out in the wilderness surrounded by a lot of snow and things around it. And then in that bright little cabin, you can have these like savant skills, maybe great music or art skills. The brain scan of the normal person is like a lamp store. You have so much stuff lit up, you can't tell which part of it's the visual center. And that's what I call using visual symbol pictures. And by doing that, I can think more abstractly and be thinking in pictures. But basically, my mind works like Google for images. You want to find out how Google for images works? Type in a noun and it will pull up a bunch of pictures, and then it gradually gets off the subject because it's associational.
Mm-hmm.
Like I might type in cup and saucer,
mm-hmm.
and then the next thing you know, I'm off into flying saucers.
Hmm.
And then the next association might be Area 51 where the UFOs are.
Wow, well, that sounds exciting.
And I'm just explaining to you how my mind works.
Sure.
It's associational, and it basically works just like Google for images.
Wow. And so along the way of this really quite rich and varied career of yours, I mean, have there been times where you've been able to sort of not only use that as an advantage, obviously, but I mean, have you found ways to sort of adapt at all so that maybe in some cases it is working, you know, maybe more with words or language, or is it just, I mean, the way your mind has worked is the way your mind has worked, and even with all the great academic and other kinds of success and publishing and designing systems, I mean, have you felt at any point there's been a variation in the way that you process information just over time and trying to move into other areas?
Well, I've been getting better, you know, much better at, you know, public speaking. Mm-hmm. People say, well, you're so good at public speaking. You know, but in the very beginning, I wasn't. The first time I tried to teach a class as a graduate student, I panicked and I walked out of the classroom. But the thing about being autistic, it's like putting more and more and more information on the hard drive of a computer.
Right.
In the beginning, you just have a few bits of information, so I kind of, kids used to call me tape recorder in high school because I always said the same thing. But then, as you put more and more and more information on that hard drive, you can then rearrange it in different ways, and it's sort of like you gradually just keep learning more and more and getting better and better.
Mm-hmm.
You almost never grow up.
Right, but it sounds like, again, that over time, as that hard drive is more and more full, then you've also find different ways to access different things and put them together so that in that respect, it might be...
I'm going to get...
Okay. ...be, to some extent, more like someone who does use language.
Well, if I'm thinking about totally new material... It's going to be in pictures, and I want you to test me. I want you to ask me something, not something I'm in my office right now, so don't ask me desk or chair or something that I can see in the office.
Okay.
Ask me something, or something real common like house or car. Ask me something kind of different, then I'll tell you how I think about it.
Just name an item, in other words?
You could name an item, you could name a concept,
okay.
Whatever you want, as long as it's not something that's going to be in my office or something that's so... common and ordinary like house or car.
Okay. How about CD player?
Okay, I just saw the CD player that I have that I own.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next picture I got was taking a broken CD player back to the store that didn't work. The next picture I get is the frustration that I have with these programmable CD players. Because I can't remember the sequence of how to push the button. Because there's no way to make a picture of it. And I get very frustrated with those gadgets. And now I see the Greek Olympics and the discus throw. And that's what I'd like to do with some of these CD players.
I see.
Throw them like a
discus. Hurl them out of frustration?
Yeah, I'd want to hurl them.
I see.
And, you know, so this is how I got, you know, uh-huh. When you first told me this, I saw the CD player... You know, I saw different CD players in the store. I'm now seeing the CD player in my car, which I really like,
yeah.
Because I just shove the CD in,
and
it just plays.
Yeah.
It just plays it.
Right.
Until I push eject.
Sure. So, wow.
Now I'm getting off on the different CDs I have,
sure.
and the music that is on them.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. Cool.
But it's just sort of like Google, you know.
Yeah.
And try ask me something a little more abstract than something like CD player.
Okay. Let's see. Could it be is it still need to be an object, or
it could be an object, or it could even be a concept of
okay.
some kind.
Okay. Claustrophobia.
Oh, the first picture I got was when I was working underneath my aunt's house, putting in the plumbing, where I was laying on my back about 2 feet, you know, of dirt, you know, and then the floor above me, and there's a lot of rattlesnakes. And it would have been really hard to get out of there. I'm now seeing all these dreadful claustrophobic places I would not want to go into, like a scale, livestock scale with a pit under it.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, I wouldn't want to go in there. You know, there's going to be snakes and things in there. Now, then I'm seeing the MRI machine that a lot of people think is claustrophobic, and I actually thought that was kind of fun.
Really?
Oh, I thought going in the MRI machine was fun. I, like, pretended it was a space shuttle. Because I knew there wasn't going to be anything bad in there, like snakes or something like that.
Yeah. Wow. That is, yeah, but that is, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm getting, you know, images of, you know, of things that, you know, okay, things that are claustrophobic to me,
mm-hmm.
like being underneath this house or
right.
getting underneath a scale where there might be something under there like scorpions or, you know.
Right.
And
so for you,
away from it.
So for you so far, it sounds like it's a question of being under something, not in something.
It's
at least
under something where I couldn't get out, and there's some danger of being in there.
Yeah. Well, then, Dr. Grandin, this in a way might bring me to something else that I found really interesting in the book as well that might be helpful for you to try to explain it, because, again, it does seem to connect or draw another connection between the way animals and autistic people think, which is this idea of hyper specificity.
Well, and let me give you a good example of that. That would be how animals make fear memories. Like in Animals in Translation in the book, they talk about this horse I call the Black Hat Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a horse that was afraid of black hats.
Right.
And that's because he was abused by somebody wearing a black hat.
Mm-hmm.
When he was abused, he was looking right at the black hat. Now, a white cowboy hat was fine, but a black cowboy hat scared him. It's you see, because that fear memory is a picture. Another example of hyperspecificity would be, I've seen with horses quite a few different ones, is let's say somebody abused him with a jointed snaffle bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get rid of that bridle and you replace it with a one-piece solid bit. He'll be fine because that feels totally different. That's a different feeling picture.
Sure. And then to sort of maybe extend it all the way, then what would be an example of an autistic person's, perhaps your own or someone else's, sort of hyper-specificity?
Well, it's detail. I mean, like in my work that I've done with the cattle, I mean, people ask me, are they afraid of getting slaughtered? They're more afraid of a piece of chain hanging down or reflection off of a wet floor.
Mm-hmm.
And autistic kids can, you know, get afraid of things where you might take them into a certain auditorium and you can't figure out why he's screaming. Well, you know, microphones, when they feed back, they make that terrible screeching sound.
Sure.
So the child looks at the microphone and he goes, ah, you know, that's a dangerous thing. And, you know, and the parents may not be able to figure out why he doesn't want to go in that auditorium. Or he sees a fire alarm box and he's going to do the same thing. I can remember as a child getting very scared when there was when the roof leaked and it made a little brown stain on my bedroom ceiling. And I had this picture of all the furniture upstairs falling through the broken ceiling into my room. Now I know enough about building to know that that could not have happened, but I did not know that at 5 years old.
And so that became a very specific kind of concern, if not obsession, I guess.
Well, no other kid would have noticed a tiny little stain on the ceiling.
Right, much less, you know, I guess, struggled with it.
Visualized furniture falling through the ceiling object.
Yeah, yeah. And really, along those lines, sort of another key element of the book that again, there's so many things so fascinating, but the idea that sort of makes sense, but again, the way it extends into autistic people as well, is the idea that animals don't really experience mixed emotions. I mean, they experience emotions, but it sounds
very strong emotions.
But one at a time, if I follow it correctly.
It's more one at a time, you see, because that's the frontal cortex. You see, the frontal cortex can associate different emotions and things and mix it all together. You know, I mean, you've all seen a situation where a dog might be growling at you 1 minute, next minute he's wagging his tail.
Mm-hmm.
And I can relate to that because there'd be situations where I'd get angry and then, you know, the next minute I was just, you know, fine. I'd be over it. Animals have emotions and they have very strong emotions, and the basic emotion circuits in animals and people are very similar.
Mm-hmm.
They definitely feel fear and pain.
Mm-hmm.
That's very well documented in scientific research. But it tends to be simpler. I don't have complicated emotions.
Mm-hmm. And also you said at one point in the book that you don't experience or even understand something like denial.
I don't understand denial. I just don't understand that where a person can be in a very, you know, bad, you know, like somebody, let's say they have an alcoholism problem and be in denial about it. I don't understand that.
And has that, I'm curious, over the years, at least has your understanding, I mean, not necessarily that you would experience it, but has your understanding of people who do experience denial changed or shifted at all?
Well, I understand that people do it,
uh-huh.
but it's not something that I do. I mean, if I do something wrong and somebody can show me very logically that it's wrong, I'll go, okay, all right, I'll try to change that.
Mm-hmm.
There's just complicated emotions I don't have. I just couldn't understand how somebody could love somebody that was beating them up. I mean, that's beyond my comprehension.
Right, right. And yet, as part of this overall puzzle, at least on the animal side, you explain at 1.2 that animals develop superstitions.
Yeah, you can get a situation where, you know, you have a pig that's eating from a feeder where she has an electronic key, sort of like, you know, the card that you stick in the door at the hotel.
Sure.
Except that's in her ear. There's a little button put in her ear that's the equivalent of one of those hotel cards. And when she goes up to the feeder, the computer will give her her feed. Well, some animals will do little weird things that they think makes... They don't know that they have the key in a little tag in their ear.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know that.
Right.
And, you know, where a person knows, well, yeah, I'm sticking a card in a door.
And this is the result, yeah.
You know, but let's say the card was in your, just, glue, you know, in your pocket and you didn't know it was there. And then, you know, like you walk by certain rooms and you can just get in. You know, like those security systems where you have the ID card, you wear them around your neck.
Sure.
And then if you walk, put it up against a sensor, it lets you through the door.
Right.
Well, you use that same technology in certain systems where sows are housed, you know, housed loose. This is one of the ways to get rid of the sow stalls that are so controversial.
Mm.
And so you put the sows in a big room, and each one has one of these key cards similar to these security systems. And it will let her into the feeder so she can get her allotment of feed once a day. Well, the sow doesn't know that she has the card. She doesn't know that the thing in her ear opens the feeder. She doesn't know that.
Right.
So maybe she might be stamping her foot right when she goes up to the feeder. Well, then she'll go up there and stamp her foot because she thinks that makes the feed come out.
Uh-huh. So she's seeing, in some way, a cause and effect. This is not the accurate one.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Because
wow.
She doesn't know that she has an electronic key in her...
Be, to some extent, more like someone who...
That's in her ear tag.
Yeah. And speaking of sows and this kind of thing, I mean, you no doubt have heard this question way too many times probably at this point, but it's almost incumbent on me to ask about the apparent sort of dichotomy of being someone who clearly loves animals and has studied them and cared for them and done all kinds of things, and at the same time has spent much of your professional life, at least, working in the meatpacking industry.
Well, I'm working in the meatpacking industry because it's one place where I can really make some change take place.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very strongly that we can raise animals ethically for food. Cattle probably is, when they're done right, probably got the best welfare of all the animals.
Mm-hmm.
Egg-laying chickens have some of the worst problems. And, you know, first of all, the cattle would never be born if we hadn't, you know, bred those cattle.
Sure.
But I feel very strongly that we owe these animals a decent life.
Right.
And I've got a lot of concerns, and some of my concerns are genetic, where we get into problems where we're pushing animals' biology too hard. Lameness in the dairy industry is just terrible. Breeding pigs for lean, 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 and then they got hyper. You know, breeding chickens to just grow more and more until they got leg problems.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the industry is starting to correct some of these problems, but I'm very, very concerned about that.
Sure, sure. Well, and really, I guess it's, you know, obviously not really contradictory because a lot of your work has been developing and you know, taking around and putting into places more humane systems for.
And the other thing you've got to do is you've got to get people to manage these systems.
Yeah.
And I've worked with the restaurant companies like McDonald's and Wendy's
right. On
auditing the plants, and I developed a very simple objective scoring system that an auditor can use to assess the plants. And it gets away from opinion about them.
Yeah, well, that was another thing that was really fascinating is the idea that the way you developed that, in contrast to the way others had been done, and I guess probably in many cases still are done, the idea that really, like a sort of a 10-point plan, if I'm remembering this correctly, is actually better and more effective than a 100-point plan.
Well, you have to figure out what are the really important things to measure. There are certain things where... I call them critical control points, where if you fail on these points, you ought to fail, period. Like
sure.
Stunning, for example, would be one of them. Another one would be animals falling down during handling.
Yeah.
You know, instead of going in there and trying to tell a plant how to build their floors, let's look at how many animals slip and fall.
Right.
They're only allowed to have 1 out of 100 fall down. If more than 1 out of 100 falls down, they fail the audit.
Right.
Now, they could fall down because the floor is slippery, or they could fall down because people were yelling and screaming and getting them all excited.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You see, a good critical control point measures a multitude of sins.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is figuring out the right 5 things to measure.
Yeah.
And one of the ones that works super well is vocalization in cattle. That's mooing and bellowing. When cattle moo and bellow while you're handling them, they're upset and stressed. And it used to be in the plants. You'd go in there and there was just constant mooing and bellowing, you know, and to pass the audit, they're only allowed to have 3 cattle out of 100 mooing and bellowing. And they're doing it. Now, I want to add that about 90% of the beef and pork plants are now in these audit systems.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, there still are some plants outside of these audit systems where there's some very bad things have been going on.
Well, and speaking of that, I mean, well, two things at least that come to mind, and I know we're sort of nearing the end of our time, but I'm just going to keep going and cram as much as we can because there's just so much fascinating stuff here. I was interested to find that KFC is actually one of the companies that you've been working with to sort of raise the standards for animal welfare in the poultry industry. So I'm curious, how do you view kind of PETA, you know, specifically targeting KFC's practices and the findings recently of that undercover video investigation?
Well, that situation where the chickens are being thrown against the wall, that was absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of stuff happens when you're not managing a plant.
Mm-hmm.
And you see now the plants that are starting to get into the auditing systems, you have outside third-party auditors, independent auditors auditing a plant. You also have the internal quality control people at the plant auditing a plant. And then another project I'm involved in right now is putting video cameras into plants that can be audited by you remotely through a secure website by third-party auditors to get around the problem of them acting good when the auditor's there.
And how willing are people? I mean, I remember when Ingrid Newkirk was on the show, and we talked, because when I interviewed her was not long after the whole KFC, undercover video investigation. So she was kind of saying that that's something that people were advocating, but she felt realistically, for the kind of reason you just alluded to, that the companies themselves wouldn't agree to that.
Well, actually, there is a major meat company right now that has agreed to have these cameras installed.
Great.
I just talked to the company that's going to be putting the cameras in today,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to be putting these cameras in. They're not put in yet.
Yeah,
but they're going
to
it. And when the equipment all gets in and up and operating, you know, then I can tell you who it is. But right now, while it's
too
still,
soon, yeah.
Well, you got to get it put in, get it working first. Sure.
Wow, well, that's just encouraging to know that there is a major.
Yes, it's a major, yeah. Major meat company that's going to be working on this.
Great. Well, we'll
and
hope
I'm really,
to.
Really pleased about that. And I just have to keep working on getting things better and better. I just also want to add that in Animals in Translation, I've got a troubleshooting guide in the back of the book that's going to help people with their animal behavior problems, and that is written in my regular technical writing.
Yeah, you wrote that, as I understand it, strictly, whereas the bulk of the book was this collaboration between you and
well,
Catherine
Johnson. The book itself is a collaboration.
Yeah.
The troubleshooting guides are an appendix
that
I thought, you know, that people that are real serious about trying to solve behavior problems in animals will find useful, because the thing you've got to figure out is what's the animal's motivation. Is it fear or is it aggression?
Mm-hmm.
One of the most common mistakes that people make is they mix up fear and aggression.
Yeah.
And if you punish an animal that's fearful, you just make it worse. And the troubleshooting guide is going to help you figure out, do you have a scared dog or a scared horse, or do you have an aggressive horse?
Yeah. And Dr. Grant, you know, when we were talking about the meat packing and some of these advances that you're making, I just wanted to sort of point out that, you know, many people, prominent people in the animal world are assumed to be vegetarian, but you're not.
No, I'm not.
But I think it's really interesting, too, at least if I understand it correctly, why you're not, and it sounds like it's actually a health thing that you've actually tried to embrace a vegetarian diet,
actually,
but that it doesn't.
If I don't get some animal protein, I just can't function.
And
I've been finding that quite a few people that have dyslexia and have some of the other problems, they need to have the animal protein.
Yeah, that it's that there's been a connection with various people with various processing problems. I think you said at one point in the book.
Yes, there is. And non-autistic people that may have visual processing problems,
mm-hmm.
they have problems with driving at night. They have problems with getting on and off escalators. There's some people that really need to have animal protein. I'm one of them, and I think if you went to a really well-run plant, you'd be pleasantly surprised. The cattle just walk up the ramp.
Yeah.
And if you drop a paper cup in the middle of the ramp, they're not going to walk up there. And again, I want to emphasize, we've got to give animals a decent life.
Yeah.
And I have to say that I started out originally as a beef person. And when I got taken into the egg layer house for the first time, I was just horrified. I was absolutely horrified. They had these hens jammed in so tight that when they laid down at night to sleep, they were all on top of each other.
I
just thought it was absolutely disgusting. Now, the egg industry is making some changes, but that's an industry that went way too far down a bad highway on, you know, over-confinement. And I have to say, as a beef person, to see layers with half their feathers out because they were nervous wrecks, and that's genetics. It's not the cages that make the feathers come off. It's genetics.
Wow.
And I have a lot of problems with that.
Yeah.
I'd rather have my beef cattle that are out there, you know, grazing, you know, the mama cows and the bulls are out there, you know, grazing on the range, and then they do go in feed yards, but they're still outside.
Sure. Sure. Well, in fact, near the end of the book, really, you express a hope that we'll start to think more about animals, what animals can do, and less about what they can't. And even like quoting you now, I guess we've sort of gotten too far away from animals who should be our partners in life, our pets or objects of study. Ideally, what would that mean? What would that look like?
Well, I mean, I kind of like the biological concept of symbiosis. I mean, first of all, none of these animals would exist if we hadn't bred them.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's a dog or a horse or, you know, whatever the animal is.
Sure.
And you know, like with the agricultural animals, like cattle, pigs, I mean, we owe them a decent life.
Mm-hmm.
And a egg-laying hen should not be jammed in a cage so tight that they sleep on top of each other.
Right.
I mean, this just goes beyond any, you know, common decency. I just couldn't believe it when I saw that.
Sure.
And I think some of the people had forgotten they were dealing with a live animal. Now, in fairness to the egg association, they have been, you know, working on gradually changing these things. And customers like supermarkets and restaurants insisting on this is one of the things that brings about the change.
Sure.
And you have major buyers of the meat saying, you're going to have to change this, or we're not going to buy from you.
Yeah. It seems like that's really, whether, like you said, it's McDonald's or now KFC and Burger King, some others, and other, you know, just companies that aren't in the fast food business. I mean, once they put their foot down, that's where it seems like people listen,
chicken,
right?
In chicken. Company that's really going to bring about some changes is going to be Wendy's. They're doing some very, very good things in chicken.
Great.
I'm very, very happy about that. And then I've also been working with Whole Foods on their animal guidelines. And one of the things I've been working on, we've got to have guidelines that we can audit. We've got to get away from these wishy-washy words like sufficient, adequate, and proper. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah. Open to interpretation. So
that's open
then,
to interpretation.
Then, yeah.
I mean, you've got to have a clear-cut guideline like if all the animals, like the chickens, for example, must have enough room so they can lay down without being on top of each other.
Right. That's sufficient. Yeah.
That defines it very clearly.
Right. Yeah, there's no room for...
And they must have enough, like, just for regular commercial hens. You know, the guideline I've been using, this is just... So you have different, you know, let's say regular commercial hens, they all have got to be able to eat at the same time.
Yeah.
And be able to lay down at the same time without being on top of each other. And, you know, then other... You know, if you want to be a little nicer to hens, you can do what's called barn eggs, where they're loose running around on the floor, and they go in nest boxes.
Well, so it sounds like you're encouraged about the changes that are afoot, that are coming. So,
you know, there's a lot, you know, a lot of improvements. And you see, the other thing I think so interesting is the new research that's being done on animal cognition. You know, that animals really can think and solve a problem under novel conditions. And some of the most fascinating research has been done with birds, with crows, and with Irene Pepperberg's parrot that knows, you know, a few hundred words. And
Alex
the parrot.
Oh, my God. So
Alex
incredible. Yeah.
And but some of the work with crows is really good, because I was just reading a brand new article. It's not in the book because it just came out.
About
crows that were able to, that figured out how to make tools when they'd never, ever, ever, ever seen another bird work a tool.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it does seem like in your book and elsewhere that it's really birds that are incredibly smart and adapting and problem solving in a whole different way.
Another thing on the smart animals, it tends to be the long lived animals, and the other really interesting cognitive thing is the research that's been done on prairie dogs up in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Oh yeah.
Where they're using like a noun-like, and verb-like, and adjective-like components. Now, they're not a long-lived animal, so now that kind of ruins my thesis, but it doesn't, because the colony is long-lived.
Yeah.
You know, you have a colony that'll be there for many years. And then the other thing you have with prairie dogs is that they have specific coyotes, like the one that sits by the hole, the one that, like, lurks around, sneaks around from hole to hole. And then they have a way of describing the different coyotes that they get to know that predator on them.
It's incredible. I mean, that, and there's all those kinds of stories and more. It's name of the book is Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. Dr. Grant, actually, one last quick question, just because I've this one I haven't seen asked before. Temple is such a lovely, distinctive name. Is that, what's the origin? Is that a family name,
it's
or is that?
It's an old family surname.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great. Cool. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us here on Talking Animals, and I want to, you know, congratulate you again on the success of the book. I totally understand it, and I hope everyone listening will feel inclined to go out and get a copy themselves. I think they'll be thrilled that they did, and thank you again for all your great work over all these many years.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks
okay.
so much.
All right. Yeah, bye.
All right. I want to thank again Dr. Temple Grandin for joining us on Talking Animals. The book, one more time, is Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. Website is simplygrandin.com. And now we're in the Name That Animal tune. It's like Name That Tune, except it's animal related. So can you name this animal tune? Can you? All right, well, if you can name that animal tune, it's 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI, and you have your choice of those prizes we mentioned earlier, from the new DVD by Triumph Insult Comic Dog, to various shirts and T-shirts and coffee mugs that are all Talking Animals related, to other cool cat and dog accessories and more. So I'm Duncan Strauss. We've just about reached the end of this week's edition of Talking Animals. I want to remind you that the views and opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KUCI, UCI, or the University of California Board of Regents. I want to thank again our guest, Dr. Temple Grandin, for joining us on Talking Animals. One more time, the book is Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. And really just wonderful, fascinating books. And it is, as we talked about in the interview, so conversational and just breezy, and yet just packed with great ideas and totally accessible. I mean, it's a pretty amazing achievement, really. So, and also her website is grandin.com to find out more about, you know, all of her other books and articles and some of the consulting work she's done that we just didn't have time to get into in that interview. But thank you all for listening. I hope you'll join us next Monday, February 14th, when our guest will be Vicki Stevens, Director of Programs at the Doris Day Animal Foundation, who are organizers of Spay Day USA, held this year on February 22. So there'll be lots of great important stuff to discuss with Vicki. Again, I want to urge you to check out our website, TalkingAnimals.net. And once you get there, please sign up for our email list so we can alert you to guest bookings and other events, announcements, etc. Also, I encourage you to email us with comments, guest suggestions, ideas about show topics, songs, comedy bits, news stories, anything else you'd like to pass along at talkinganimals@AOL.com. I really look forward to hearing from you. Really? No, I'm serious. I do. Please stay tuned for Jeff Scott and the Blues Disease, his great, great, great blues show here at KUCI. This has been Talking Animals on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And as always, we're closing things out here with an animal-related tune. This is the Blackheart Procession with a number called Dog Song on KUCI. We'll catch you next week on Talking Animals. It's 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine.